Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome back to Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. You know, many of you have likely heard the term MS. Well, MS is an abbreviation for the neurological disorder called multiple sclerosis. It was once a diagnosis considered nearly always debilitating, and now persons with MS have many, many treatment options that can slow progression and even allow a normal lifestyle for many persons. As you know, Health Matters is a live show, and you can call and join our discussion. The number here is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have three guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Ali Menegar. He is professor and chairman of neurology here at the Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. We also, again, we have Dr. Megan Harris. Dr. Harris is a neurologist here at the Highland Clinic, and we are honored to have a patient with the disorder with us tonight. Her name is Deanne, and she has joined us for the show. Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your questions or comments, 1-800-552-8502, and our topic tonight is multiple sclerosis. Dr. Menegar, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I would like to say hello to all the listeners and say thank you to you and Mrs. Moran for giving me this opportunity to be here to answer some questions.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. You know, I understand multiple sclerosis has long been considered an autoimmune disease that affects the central nervous system. Tell us a little bit about what you would consider symptoms of multiple sclerosis or signs that patients or their families may look for if they believe that they might have symptoms of MS or multiple sclerosis.
This is an excellent question. As you mentioned, it's considered an autoimmune disease when the immune system starts attacking central nervous system antigens, in this case, the myelin sheath that is wrapped around the axons and is involved in rapid transmission of impulses. Eventually, it leads to loss of axons themselves, and that's when the disability develops. MS is a disease usually that you can see it in young individuals. The peak age for MS, based on many epidemiological studies, is 29 years, and it can affect children, but it's usually seen during the ages 16 to 60. And the typical patient is a Caucasian female, and for reasons that we are still exploring, MS is more commonly seen and more commonly affects female individuals. The most common form of MS, relapsing remitting MS, is a form that the women outnumber men by 2-to-1. And the symptoms or the manifestations that should alert individuals to such a diagnosis are if the patient has unexplained numbness or weakness, double vision, blurry vision, loss of vision, tingling in distal extremities, electric shock sensation when the individual is bending his or her neck forward, tremor, slurred speech, excessive fatigue, dizziness, problems with controlling bladder or bowel, unexplained falls, cognitive problems such as memory loss, and even sometimes mood disorders can lead to a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. Because MS affects various areas of the brain and the spinal cord, therefore, its clinical manifestations are wide, and it's not just one pinpoint or one concentrated area that you can say, if you have this, this is indicative of MS. So people should be alert of these type of manifestations and ask this question, whether this individual suffers from multiple sclerosis or not.
Thank you so much, Dr. Menegar. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. This is a weekly live show, and we invite you to join our discussion. The number here for your call, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a call at RRR Public Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and I'm your host. And our next guest we have with us tonight, we have Dr. Megan Harris. Dr. Harris, thank you so much for coming back to Health Matters.
Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely. So what can you tell us regarding the incidence and prevalence of multiple sclerosis? Is this something that's common? Is it becoming more common, or has it leveled out?
I think overall it's being found more often. On average, there's about 200 new cases of MS diagnosed per week in the United States. That could be due to people seeing the symptoms more frequently. We now have better techniques to diagnose it. But overall, there's about 400,000 people living in the United States with multiple sclerosis and about 2.3 to 2.5 million people worldwide with the disease. It's more commonly seen in places in the northern areas over southern areas closer to the equator, and patients have a higher risk in northern areas. So it is something that we are seeing more frequently, possibly just due to better techniques of identifying it.
Thank you so much. Again, this is Health Matters. The topic is multiple sclerosis. The number is 1-800-552-8502. You can tweet us a question as well, at RRR Public Radio. We are very happy to have a guest with us tonight that actually has multiple sclerosis. Deanne, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what your experience was when you first learned that, you know, you were having difficulty and that it could have been what you went through at that point, at the first part of your illness.
Well, the very first thing I noticed was, excuse me, at work we had a hallway that was curved, and I noticed that every time I would walk down that hallway, I would feel dizzy. And, you know, I thought, is there something in the air? I mean, what's up with this, you know? So then, not long after that, my teeth started to chatter one day, but I wasn't cold. So that definitely got my attention. And then finally, I think the thing that sent me to the doctor is one day I was getting on the elevator, and someone said, did you hurt your foot? And I said, no. And they said, well, you're limping. So that sent me to the doctor.
So about how long were these symptoms present before you figured out you needed to get some help?
Yeah, I think that was over about a three-month period.
Okay, did it start pretty quickly? Did it escalate fairly rapidly once the symptoms started, or were they fairly mild?
They were fairly mild. The teeth chattering thing was only one time. The dizziness would happen like every week, but I wasn't convinced that maybe there was something wrong with the air conditioning in that hallway, or, you know, there was another reason for it other than me. And as far as the limping goes, for a while, I felt like that I was walking funny is the best way I can describe it, but no one ever said anything until that day. And when they did, that's when I said, well, I better get this checked out.
And so, Dr. Menegar, when a patient presents with these sorts of symptoms, and as a neurologist, what's your initial approach in terms of what sort of questions would you ask the patient and look for on examination if you were concerned about, you know, where this is in the nervous system and what's going on with that?
The questions we ask are focused on those symptoms which I mentioned, such as weakness, abnormal sensory feelings, such as numbness, tingling, if they have double vision, or if they fall without any explanation, or if they have any ocular problems, such as blurry vision or double vision or urinary or fecal incontinence. We ask these questions and we try to secure a comprehensive and very accurate history of this patient, that how these symptoms began. For example, one particular point we see in our clinic, many of our patients who are young females presents during the time after they have delivered their child. And they say that after the delivery, a few weeks to a few months after that, I developed my first symptoms. Once we collect all this information and also ask them if there is anybody else in their family with the same problem, do you have any siblings who has the same problems? Or do you have any siblings or your parents have any autoimmune disease such as type 1 diabetes or anything else, or lupus that is from this family? Do you have those? And once we get the answers about those, then we focus on the neurological examination. For example, we specifically look at the presence of any weakness. Most of our patients are physically well-built and otherwise healthy. So therefore, we shouldn't find any weakness in their exam. We look at their eye movements. We look at their pupillary reactions to light. And we look at their fundus. We look at their basically sensory examination to see if we can find any objective findings, if they have hyperactive reflexes. And then we ask them to walk to see how they walk, how their gait and station is, and if they need help, such as using a cane or a walker, and if they are prone to falls. These are all clues towards a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. In general, if you talk to older generations of neurologists, they would tell you multiple sclerosis is a clinical diagnosis. And if you have a patient who presents with one or a set of neurological problems that last more than 24 hours, that can be considered an attack of MS. And if you can elicit from the history that the patient has had two attacks and these two attacks are separated by 1 month of instability, then you can raise the question whether this patient has multiple sclerosis or not. Of course, one should be very cautious about making such a diagnosis because there are many other diseases that imitate multiple sclerosis. So this is, in summary, how we approach these patients with our history and neurological examination.
Thank you so much. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and the show tonight is a live one. This is Health Matters. I'm your host. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. And our topic is multiple sclerosis. Our guest tonight, we have Dr. Ali Menegar, professor and chairman, Department of Neurology, here at the LSU School of Medicine in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Megan Harris, a neurologist here at the Highland Clinic. And we have a patient with us tonight who has multiple sclerosis. Her name is Deanne. Deanne, Dr. Menegar mentioned that, you know, autoimmune diseases can run in families. Did you have anyone in your family that had an autoimmune disease that you were aware of before?
As a matter of fact, I had a cousin with lupus and a cousin with ALS.
Okay.
And my mother and three of her siblings had like a genetic form of emphysema that was related to their immune system.
Very interesting. Dr. Harris, when you're working a patient up and you think that they may have MS and you've done, you know, the thorough history and the physical examination, what's your next step if it's really high on your index of suspicion, if you will?
The next step, we generally run an MRI scan. So a lot of people have an idea that maybe a CAT scan sometimes can give a diagnosis. So I'll have patients come in and they'll say, well, I had a CAT scan in the emergency room. But that doesn't really give a clear idea that this is multiple sclerosis. An MRI scan is our treatment, our actual study of choice when looking for multiple sclerosis. We're looking for white matter lesions. So we would generally do an MRI of the brain, usually with and without contrast, because when we give contrast, we can often see a breakdown of the blood-brain barrier where contrast lights up. It can show us that there's active inflammation going on there. Oftentimes, we also get an MRI of the cervical spine, the neck, in order to see if there are lesions there. A lot of times this is missed, and I think a while back when before MRIs were so popular, you know, many patients just got MRI of the brain and the spine wasn't looked into as carefully. But now we generally do an MRI of the brain and the cervical spine. If there are lesions that look suspicious for multiple sclerosis, we can often do a lumbar puncture or a spinal tap. It mainly helps to rule out other things. So if you don't have a positive spinal tap, is what we call it, or a tap that has spinal fluid with something called oligoclonal bands, it doesn't necessarily mean you don't have multiple sclerosis. However, we do look for other things in the spinal fluid, such as infection, other autoimmune diseases, malignancy, all those things are tested when we do a spinal tap. If you do have oligoclonal bands plus MRI that looks consistent with multiple sclerosis, then generally we can give a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis if the history and physical fit with that. If there's still some question, there are always other ancillary tests, such as visual evoked potentials. So generally, we will have people hooked up and they look at this black and white checkerboard screen, and it measures how quickly the signal goes through the optic nerve. If they're slowing there, there's some indication there may be demyelination and could indicate a very subclinical finding that we can see in multiple sclerosis. There are other newer tests, something called OCT testing that an eye doctor can do, that can also measure the retinal fiber layer in the eyes, that can sometimes give us an idea about previous optic neuritis or an optic nerve problem that a patient may not have even been aware of.
Dr. Menegar, is that common in your practice to have patients who have, I'm sure being in the academic setting, you're going to be thrown mostly curveballs and not very many, you know, straightforward cases. But is that common in your practice to see patients who have this sort of MS that's difficult to diagnose and you have to do more extensive testing?
That's entirely correct. We at the tertiary medical center get referrals from all over Louisiana State, Texas, and the state of Arkansas. And as a policy that we have with our medical center, we are open to any referrals, any difficult cases that other neurologists cannot handle them or cannot reach a diagnosis. Therefore, we have a significant number of patients who are under the suspicion of whether they have multiple sclerosis or not. Some of these cases, when we look at their MRIs, when we listen to their history and do neurological exam, we rule out MS because we see that there is no conclusive evidence that they have MS. Some of them, we diagnose them with MS. And in occasional cases, we have to undiagnose a patient with MS because the MS diagnosis is not correct. Then we have a large population that are in the gray zone that we can't make a conclusive diagnosis whether it is MS or not. So what we do, we follow them for a minimum of 2 to 5 years, and we periodically examine them, and if they have any symptoms, we repeat their MRIs to see if they have multiple sclerosis or not. Sometimes a neurologist should be patient and follow the patient during the course of time to see if they develop certain symptoms or manifestations that are consistent with MS. In some cases, it's truly a challenge to diagnose it correctly.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and this is Health Matters Tonight. Our topic is multiple sclerosis. The number for your calls, 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet us a question at RRR Public Radio. I'm your host. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our guest tonight, Dr. Megan Harris, a neurologist with the Highland Clinic, as well as the chairman of the Department of Neurology here in Shreveport at LSU, Dr. Ali Menegar, and Deanne, a patient with multiple sclerosis, who has gratefully given us her time tonight. Deanne, you know, Dr. Menegar mentioned that the diagnosis can be difficult to make. How was the diagnostic process for you as you were, you know, going through the health system, trying to figure out what was going on with you when you were initially diagnosed?
Fortunately, Dr. Menegar was able to look beyond just my brain MRI, and because my lesions were in my neck. And so he was able to diagnose me that way.
So I understand it is very commonly found in the neck. And is that common in your practice, in a community practice, Dr. Harris, for the brain lesions to be absent at the initial diagnosis and symptoms to be predominantly perhaps in just the optic nerve or perhaps just the cervical spine and the optic nerve?
It sometimes occurs. When we do get situations like that, when we just see lesions in the neck and the optic nerve, obviously, multiple sclerosis is very high on our ideas of what this could be. There are some other things that sometimes it can mimic MS. One of the main ones in this particular case when we just see spinal cord lesions is something called DeVicks disease, another autoimmune type disease. So we generally will check for that as well. If we just see spinal cord lesions and other symptoms that would be consistent with multiple sclerosis, as Dr. Menegar said, sometimes we just have to be patient and continue to MRI the patient's brain and see if more things pop up. But we definitely see it more in the academic setting rather than the community setting in those cases where there's just cord lesions.
And so we mentioned following these patients over time. And so that sort of gets to the varieties of MS, doesn't it? Isn't there a type that comes and goes, the relapsing remitting type, and then there's a little bit more progressive form of MS. Tell us a little bit about the different types of multiple sclerosis that are possible.
So the most common type is relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. It occurs in 85% of all patients with MS. It's a type where you get a symptom, and within a period of time, it generally goes away or almost completely goes away. It may not ever get back to baseline, but you do have some resolution of the symptoms. You can go for a period of time where things are normal and then suddenly get another symptom. It could be in a different area. It could be a visual problem or a weakness problem, a balance problem. It depends where the lesion occurs in the brain. Again, you go through this period of time where you're having trouble with the symptom and then it'll go away. That's a relapsing remitting type course. Eventually, many of these patients with relapsing remitting MS will progress to a second type called secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. So before we had treatment or before we started treating patients very early on, the old statistic was if you had untreated multiple sclerosis that was relapsing remitting MS, you would develop secondary progressive MS within 10 to 12 years. Now that we have earlier treatment, we can prolong that period of time. We also have progressive types of multiple sclerosis, which would be a progressive from the onset. That's primary progressive. So you gradually get worse over time from the very beginning. It tends to be a more aggressive form. And then progressive relapsing. So not only do you get worse over a period of time, but you have relapses on top of it, which would be considered one of the worst types. For the progressive types of multiple sclerosis, we don't have really good treatments available right now, which is good that most people have relapsing remitting type because we do have treatments available for this.
Again, this is listener-supported Red River Radio, and this is a live show tonight. It's Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer, and you can call us with questions about multiple sclerosis. The number is 1-800-552-8500. Our guest tonight, Dr. Ali Menegar, neurology professor and chairman at LSU here in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Megan Harris, neurologist at the Highland Clinic. Deanne is also here with us, a patient with MS. Deanne, Dr. Harris was talking about the different types of multiple sclerosis. Have you been given a type designation for your illness?
Yes, I have remitting relapsing.
And how has that been for you in terms of how many relapses and remissions have you gone through over the course of?
I think there's been three, which is not bad since I was diagnosed 17 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Dr. Menegar is taking good care of me.
Thank you.
And Dr. Menegar, whenever there is a relapse of multiple sclerosis, how is that treated versus the treatment for the prevention of a relapse? It's sort of reminding me at the moment of migraines. We have drugs to treat migraines when they happen, and we have drugs to prevent migraines. So in terms of MS, how do you treat a relapse, and how do you treat a patient with MS to prevent progression and prevent a relapse?
This is an excellent question. Let's focus on the first part about relapses. Usually patients contact us on an urgent basis that I have developed loss of vision in one eye, or I keep falling, or I have such and such symptoms. And we usually admit them to the hospital, or it can also be done outpatient basis, and we treat them with intravenous steroids 3 to 5 days. This is a standard protocol that every neurologist who treats multiple sclerosis patients is familiar with it. If the patient cannot be admitted or does not wish to be admitted, we can also offer them another treatment, which is an older treatment for MS. It's a gel called ACTH or Acthar gel. It has been recently approved for treatment of these patients. It's a subcutaneous injection. They take it once a day for 5 days. These are for acute treatments. If the patient is going through a very bad case of MS relapse and does have certain problems such as cervical spinal cord involvement or bilateral visual loss, we can also offer them other treatments such as plasma exchange. Of course, this is more experimental treatment, and we offer them on a case-by-case basis, and some people benefit from it, some people don't. It has its own complications, and the patient and the physician should be familiar and comfortable with dealing those issues. The second part of your question about the maintenance of these patients, until 1993, there was no treatment for multiple sclerosis. Now we have multiple agents, both injectable infusion medications and oral medications, pills, which have been approved by FDA for treatment of MS. The treatment of MS began in 1993 with approval of betaseron, which is a beta interferon, followed by other beta interferons, and then Copaxone, which is also another injectable medication. Then it was followed by the era of Tysabri. This is a medication that we infuse to our patients intravenously once every 28 days. It has its own strengths and its own complications, and this was followed by approval of mitoxantrone, which is a very potent medication to suppress the immune system, and then the oral medications. Now we have three different oral medications, which include Gilenya, Aubagio, and Tecfidera, which have been approved by FDA for treatment of patients with relapsing remitting MS. And recently, another medication, Lemtrada, which is an infusion which patient receives for a course of 5 days in 1 year, then the next year 3 days, was approved by FDA. So the choices are multiple, and now treatment of MS and choosing a particular medication for that patient has become an individualized process. We have to look at that particular patient and discuss with them their options, the benefits versus complications, and it's becoming an art and subspecialty by itself how to treat these individuals.
Dr. Harris, we actually have a caller who's asked the question, is MS more prevalent in any particular ethnic group or cultural group? I know we've been through that a little bit, but let's go ahead and address that again.
It's definitely more common in people of Northern European ancestry. So Caucasian females have the highest risk of multiple sclerosis and therefore the highest rate of multiple sclerosis.
Dr. Menegar, are you aware of any genetic studies that have found a gene that is prevalent in the Northern Hemisphere that tends to run in families that are affected by MS, or is that something that's still a clinical phenomenon that the geneticists haven't figured out yet?
This is a very detailed question you're asking. The answer is yes. If you look at the literature on the genetic factors of multiple sclerosis, and I emphasize this is important because when a patient with multiple sclerosis comes to my office, one of the first questions they ask is, okay, I have MS. What about my children? What is the chance they develop MS? This is a very legitimate question anybody with children or siblings asks. The answer is we cannot pinpoint one particular gene. If you look at the genetic studies that are available on sites such as PubMed or on internet, you can look. And you can also look under this name, GWAS, GWAS, which is about the basically genes associated with autoimmune diseases. This is a national study. They will show you a large number and a long list of genes that have been identified that may predispose an individual to develop multiple sclerosis. So it is not just one gene. It's a group of genes that so far have been identified. And the list is getting longer every day with more discoveries. And these genes, along with environmental factors, play a role in development of multiple sclerosis. We know as a fact that MS runs in certain families. But if you look at the best scenario, if you have a pair of twins that are monozygotic, that are having the same gene, last chromosome, everything is the same. If one of them develops MS, the chance the other one, under worst circumstances, is around 40%, not even 50%. So it tells you that genetic factors play a role. However, there is more than just genetic factors needed for someone to develop MS. It's also an observed phenomenon that MS may skip one generation, but may affect the grandchildren that are coming out of that family. So the genetic of MS is very complicated, but our knowledge is growing because based on this, we are trying to eventually get to a stage to identify which people have a higher risk compared to the average population to develop MS, and should we offer them any form of preventive therapy or not.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and our live show tonight is Health Matters, and our topic is multiple sclerosis. Our guests tonight are Dr. Ali Menegar, the chairman of the Department of Neurology here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Megan Harris, a neurologist here at the Highland Clinic, and Deanne. She is a patient with MS who has been so gracious in joining us tonight. The number for your questions, it is 1-800-552-8555. Deanne, we were talking about the genetics of MS a little bit. Do you have anyone in your family that's from Scandinavia that you know of, or Northern Europe, or part of the world?
No.
And Dr. Menegar, you mentioned that the twin studies are fairly suggested that there's a genetic component, but it's not a sure thing that an identical twin is going to get MS if the child doesn't. Are there any environmental factors or triggers that you're aware of, viruses and things along those lines, that can activate this latent gene if someone is predisposed to getting MS?
Well, a large number of epidemiological studies have been done to see what separates people who develop MS in terms of their background and their history. And a long list of viruses have been proposed that if someone has been affected or exposed to these viruses, even in childhood, has a higher chance of developing multiple sclerosis, such as Epstein-Barr virus. The problem with these studies is they cannot be reproduced beyond any reasonable doubt to suggest that. So, yes, there, for example, exposure to viruses or active infection with certain viruses have been proposed. Also, the level of vitamin D and how much exposure to sun an individual has had during childhood or even now, they have been proposed. Actually, the vitamin D is a very hot topic in the area of multiple sclerosis, and we encourage our patients to start taking vitamin D. And if they have been growing in certain parts of the world, under certain climates, they may have a higher chance of developing MS, such as certain areas in southern Canada, northern United States, New Zealand, and southeastern Australia. So all these factors have been proposed. Also, there have been studies to see if the individual has had, during the birth was by cesarean section versus routine birth. Is there any difference between their chance to develop MS? A lot of factors have been looked at, but they're not conclusive. They're only suggestive of some associations.
Dr. Harris, another question has come in. We mentioned earlier in the program some of the symptoms of multiple sclerosis, and some of those do include cognitive and emotional problems, I guess things that you wouldn't typically associate with maybe white matter disease. Is that something that you find is common in multiple sclerosis and perhaps has been somewhat under-recognized in the history of our experience with this disease?
Absolutely. It's one of the more common symptoms that people will describe, and it can happen very early on in the disease or much later on in the disease. It can be things from simple processing speed problems to short-term memory issues to having significant memory loss where people need help with their activities of daily living. The idea behind this has come out more recently because we've always felt that MS was a white matter disease, but with newer research, we now know that it's a whole brain disease. So there's a big part of inflammation that shows the lesions that we see on MRI. However, on higher Tesla MRI machines, we can see lesions in the gray matter as well. And we do see that patients with MS will get some shrinking of their brain, which is called atrophy, that may be more than a typical patient without multiple sclerosis. That part has shown that it may be more of a neurodegenerative process as well. And this neurodegeneration with loss of cells can predispose people to memory loss and trouble in that area. It's also very common for patients to have emotional disorders with multiple sclerosis. Depression rates are very high in MS. We see quite a bit of a combination of MS with bipolar, anxiety disorders. All of those are associated with it, partly because some of the lesions may be in areas that affect emotion or around the limbic system, but because it's a whole brain disease, and we're learning more and more about that.
And certainly dealing with a chronic illness, especially if you have a more fulminant type of it, like the progressive form, is going to obviously exact its toll on the coping strategies that patients may have. Deanne, what's your experience been with the cognitive and the emotional aspects of MS? How have you dealt with those issues?
I've been very blessed because I haven't had any of those problems, but I have a philosophy, and that is, I don't know, maybe this is true of any chronic illness, but it's very easy to become self-centered, and I think it's extremely important to fight that and to be as independent as you can, and to keep doing things every day that will keep your spirit alive and have hope that everything's going to be okay.
Excellent advice. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The topic tonight is multiple sclerosis. The number for your calls is 1-800-552-8502. Our guest tonight, Dr. Megan Harris, a neurologist here in Shreveport at the Highland Clinic, as well as Dr. Ali Menegar, chairman of the Department of Neurology here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as Deanne, a patient with multiple sclerosis. Dr. Menegar, when you're deciding amongst these preventive treatments in terms of a patient with multiple sclerosis, let's say, for example, you've made the diagnosis and you're thinking about how are we going to prevent this next relapse of multiple sclerosis, what goes into your decision-making process in terms of which one of these available new drugs do you choose?
This is a very interesting question because as I mentioned before, the treatment should be tailored based on that patient's characteristics and capabilities. The first thing I do is to establish a very warm and humanitarian relationship with my patients. I have learned from years of practicing medicine that if I communicate with them and have an honest and friendly relationship with them, there is a higher chance that they will take the medication and use it. So that is very important. Plus, I always tell them first, be positive, because nothing works like having a positive attitude. Then we go through the list of medications and we look at which one suits this particular person, because we need to also factor in that some of the medications may not be available to certain patients because of insurance issues. So I'm very practical with this approach and I don't give them false hopes. And we go through their options. Basically injectable versus Tysabri, which is an infusible, versus oral medications. And then based on their existing features of that particular case, it will be a joint decision between me and the patient, because I always say the patients should be involved in their care and management, because once they are involved in that and they are educated about what they're going to take, what kind of side effects they should expect, it's much easier for them psychologically to accept the treatment and be compliant. Versus if you have a very dry relationship with them and just put a name in front of them, this is your prescription, go home, it usually doesn't work.
Dr. Harris, whenever you're beginning a patient with multiple sclerosis on prevention treatment, what's your process that you go through?
Well, we do go through all of the known treatments. So I have a chart on the back of my door, basically, and we kind of go down the list. But some things that I like to learn about them first is, are they real needle phobic? What's their schedule like? Do they travel quite a bit? You know, those things have to factor in to determine, can they be in town for an infusion once a month, or do they travel and some of this medicine has to be refrigerated? How is their capability of taking oral pills? Because some people will actually take an injectable over an oral pill on a more regular basis. So once I find those characteristics out about a patient, a similar approach to Dr. Minogar is that we have a frank conversation. The bottom line is that it doesn't work if you don't take it. So we not only want the medication to be to work for them and be safe for them, but we want it to be tolerable. So everybody has their own ideas of what they will tolerate, is what I've learned. And so some people have no problems giving themselves a shot. Sometimes the interferons can cause a little flu-like symptoms. Some patients deal with that beautifully, never have a problem with it, where others really have a hard time tolerating it. So I get a feeling of what people can tolerate, and then we decide from there. And of course, depending on some of their characteristics, if it's a much more aggressive form up front, where there's a lot of contrast enhancement, a lot of inflammation, we may use medications that we would possibly hold off in other particular cases. So it just depends on the patient, their characteristics, what they will tolerate, as well as some of their MRI findings.
Do you find that financial situations play into the treatments quite a bit? Do these medications vary in their cost, or are they all fairly similar in terms of their cost and availability?
Unfortunately, now insurance plays a much bigger role than it used to. So prior to several years ago, we were usually able to get patients on medication even if they had no funding at all. The drug companies have always been very good at supplying patient assistance, providing free medication to patients. So I always say that your insurance status should never be an excuse for you not to take medication. We can usually find something that you can take. However, there are some insurance plans that do require different steps that you take. So that's been a bit of a challenge. And some of the medications tend to be more expensive than others. But on average, you're looking at medication that costs between $3,000 and $5,000 a month. They're very expensive medications. And that's with all of them that are available at this moment. So they're quite expensive. It just depends which drugs are on the preferred plans of insurance to determine which ones they will cover.
Okay, very good. This is listener-supported Red River Radio, and our program is a live one tonight. This is Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Randall Brewer, and the topic tonight is multiple sclerosis. The number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Ali Minogar is one of our guests. He's a chairman of neurology here at LSU in Shreveport. He's joined by Megan Harris, a neurologist at the Highland Clinic, as well as a patient with multiple sclerosis, Deanne. Dr. Minogar, a question came via Twitter, and the question was, did they experiment with snake venom as a treatment for MS, and has that led to any discoveries in terms of treating MS?
As far as I can tell you, the answer is no. And we do not recommend this kind of treatment, which is not FDA approved, to our patients.
Deanne, another question has come through for you. And the caller wants to know, how does MS affect you in your daily life? It sounds like you've had a successful experience so far, but how does MS affect you day to day?
Well, I worked for many, many, many years, and I finally decided about 3 years ago to work part-time instead of full-time. So I took a position that was not full of stress like my executive position was before. So that's one change. And then the other thing is now I go to physical therapy, and I have to manage my energy levels. So even a little part-time job and physical therapy 3 times a week, it's all about managing my energy.
Very good. So, you know, Dr. Harris, typically MS is worsened by heat, and exercise is going to generate heat naturally. What do you tell your patients in terms of exercise and activity?
So exercise is great for MS, but you're exactly right. Heat can exacerbate your symptoms. The best exercise for MS patients is actually pool therapy or aquatic therapy. You can keep your core body temperature down, but still get a good exercise. That's not available to everyone. So we generally recommend exercise in a air-conditioned environment. So if it's in a gym or a wellness center, anything like that. Oftentimes we do use physical therapy sort of as a tune-up for our patients. And that tends to be helpful as well because they can actually do some passive strength and exercise training without increasing their core body temperature.
Dr. Menegar, we had another question that was oriented towards symptom management in multiple sclerosis, and you mentioned a number of symptoms. We've talked about emotional symptoms, memory difficulty. I treat patients with pain, actually, and a number of patients with MS have pain as well, and spasticity can be a problem. So can you give us your approach to symptom management in multiple sclerosis as opposed to these disease-modifying agents that we've been talking about?
This is another arm in management and treatment of patients with multiple sclerosis, how to deal with their symptoms. As I mentioned, MS as a disease affects various areas of human central nervous system. Therefore, the symptoms are variant. And the most common complaint that we have from MS patients is fatigue. Basically, this is a very abnormal, overwhelming feeling of either mental or physical fatigue that a patient sleeps 8 to 10 hours, and then they wake up, and after 1 hour of regular activity, they're so tired that they have to take a nap or basically lay down on a couch. There are multiple medical and non-medical routes to deal with this. As Dr. Harris pointed out, we always encourage patients to exercise. It helps them to deal with fatigue. Of course, there are other medications that are used off-label for treatment of fatigue, such as amantadine, that sometimes works in some patients. We encourage them, if they can or they're interested in and tolerate, drink coffee. It can make them more focused and more attentive. In terms of their other symptoms, it goes symptom by symptom. For example, if they have a spasticity, we can treat them with certain medications such as baclofen or tizanidine, or if it's very severe, Botox injections, or in extreme cases, an intrathecal baclofen pump is being used. For emotional incontinence, this is a situation that patient bursts into episodes of laughter or crying without any specific reason. This is a common neurological problem seen in diseases such as MS and a stroke. There is a medication which recently was introduced, Nudexta. We use that, or other medications that we use them. For depression, we treat them for depression like any other depression, and if necessary, we refer them to psychiatrists. It's very important for patients dealing with physicians dealing with MS patients to search for depression or any signs of tendency or thoughts about suicide. We want to make every effort to keep our patients alive and healthy. So if there is any thought about suicide, they should be referred to a psychiatrist or be admitted to a psychiatric service to make sure they don't take their own lives. In terms of other symptoms such as weakness, nothing works like regular exercise. As soon as the diagnosis of MS is made, the next day the patient should start regular exercise as much as they can tolerate. And depending on their case, there are certain activities they do. MS is a disease that affects locomotion, affects the legs significantly, affects the patient's walking. So we ask them to walk, to use a stationary bike if they can, with various exercises that they can focus on their lower extremities. So depending on their symptoms, there are treatments, there are ways to help them to make their life more pleasant.
Dr. Harris, what's the most common symptom that you see that requires, you know, attention out in the community as a neurologist that specializes in MS?
Fatigue is by far the most common thing that we hear of, and it's the most debilitating to people because it truly affects the way they live. Like Deanne said, a lot of patients actually have to change their jobs, sometimes go on disability just because of fatigue. So that's probably the most disabling one that I see. But oftentimes, and what a lot of people don't realize, it is pain. That can be a huge issue in a lot of people, and it can come in the form of spasticity or numbness and tingling, burning sensations, either from their spinal cord lesions or central type pain. It's very difficult to deal with in a lot of these people. And again, it is another thing that can affect their mobility when MS is already affecting their mobility. So those sorts of things are probably at the forefront of what patients will come in to talk about and we have to give symptomatic treatments for.
Deanne, what has been your experience in terms of both the preventive treatments, if you have experience with those, and symptomatic treatments?
I have 17 years of preventive treatments, and I think it's been very successful. I take a daily shot. In terms of symptoms, when it comes to pain, for example, you just have to power through or you're going to create yet another problem. And so I have these rules for myself that I don't, no matter how bad it gets, I just don't allow myself to take pain medicine more than 3 times a week. As far as the fatigue goes, you know, your body is saying, don't move, sit down, rest, and you have to be the boss of your body and say, no, I'm going to exercise now. No, I'm going to do this now.
In terms of hobbies and things along those lines and support groups, is that something that you've connected with as a patient with MS?
You know, I really have not because the best way I can put this is I have MS, but MS doesn't have me. It's not my life. It just happens to be something that I contend with, but it's not the central factor to my life.
Sure. Dr. Harris, do you find that support groups can be helpful for patients who are having difficulty with symptomatic management of MS and learning more about treatments that are available?
In some people, yes, it can be quite helpful. The key is to get into a group that wouldn't be considered to be a pity party. I know that sounds fairly harsh, but in patients that do get into groups where it's all about focusing on the negative, sometimes that can be harmful. So our patients that go to groups, and we have a great group in Shreveport, there's groups around the area that can go to these positive groups. It can be very helpful for them and their caregivers as well to see some positive results and to get on the same page with others.
So we've got just a couple more minutes, and let's look out into the frontier. Can we get myelin back into these brains?
Gosh, I hope so. I think that the frontier is going to be great. It's something that I'm very excited about. There are clinical trials ongoing right now about remyelinating drugs. That's the big hot topic. It looks like it's going to be promising. There are several new preventative drugs on the horizon. They range from infusions to some injectables. More pills are going to be coming out. You know, always the idea of stem cells pop up, that everybody's big hot topic question. There are lots of clinical trials going on that anybody can look up under the NIH website under clinical trials that would be interested in things like that. So there are not only disease preventatives, but things that may be able to help repair damage that's already been there.
So even disease reversing agents may be on the frontier.
That's what we're looking into now.
Dr. Menegar, what's your take on the future of MS treatment and reversal?
The future looks bright. It's very important to realize that progress towards treatment and eradicating MS is not going to happen overnight. It's a marathon, but not a sprint. It takes a lot of effort, and a lot of scientists and physicians around the globe are working round the clock to find better and safer and more effective treatments for these individuals. We are moving forward, and I think the future will be much better in near future.
So, Dr. Menegar, you're mentioning the future. In terms of the drugs that are in clinical trials to remyelinate, how are those drugs working?
They're basically working to see if they can stimulate oligodendrocytes. These are the cells that generate myelin sheath within the central nervous system to generate more myelin for these individuals and to see if they can prevent further myelin loss in the areas that are already damaged. So they're taking small but persistent steps forward towards establishing this.
Very good. Let's try the caller again. We have a caller. Thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Yes, I'm Sheila, and thanks for taking my call. But over the last 5 years or so, I have been tested in various ways for MS and have had it, I think, ruled out. But I still have symptoms that seem to always line up with what you guys are talking about. How can I know for sure that I don't have it? I've had an MRI on my head, neck, and back. I've had a spinal tap. I've had blood work. How can I know for sure?
Absolutely. Very common. Dr. Harris, what's your approach to that?
Well, we see patients like you quite a bit, Sheila. And, you know, basically, as Dr. Menegar said, we do follow you and we would get periodic MRIs. But remember, there are lots of things that can mimic MS, and make sure that people are looking for other potential causes for your symptoms besides multiple sclerosis, because there are other things out there. And sometimes it takes longer for those things to sort of show their head and figure out what they are. You're not the only one.
Thanks to Dr. Megan Harris with the Highland Clinic here in Shreveport. Thank you to Dr. Ali Menegar, the chairman of the Department of Neurology here at the Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport, as well as thanks to Deanne, a patient with multiple sclerosis who has joined us this evening. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download, or you may listen to a podcast of the program on our website, redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Tonight, production assistance was provided by Mr. Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Mr. Tim Snell. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Lyon Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Join us next week. Mental Health Edition of Health Matters will be talking about memory and memory disorders. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.